It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, new emergency rules aim to address a teacher shortage in Wisconsin. We'll find out what could change in the upcoming school year.
First, a federal judge in Hawaii ordered key changes to guidelines in President Trump's travel ban on six majority Muslim countries. Judge Derek K. Watson ruled that grandparents and other close relatives of Americans should not be prevented from entering the United States under the ban. The ruling also made it easier for some refugees to enter the country.
Last month, the Supreme Court decided that it would allow a scaled-back version of the travel ban to go into effect. Travelers from the six countries would be exempt from the 90-day ban if they could show that they had a, quote, bona fide relationship to an American person or entity.
Hiroshi Motomura joins us now. He's a professor at UCLA's School of Law and a scholar of immigration and citizenship. Hiroshi, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, that key phrase there, bona fide relationship, appears to be what's at issue in this case. What had the Trump administration decided what counted as a bona fide relationship for someone to get in versus what this judge is now saying?
Well, there's a couple of different angles on this. One is what kinds of relationship are a bona fide relationship in the family context, and the other is what's a bona fide relationship in the refugee context. That's a separate set of issues, but on the family part of it, I think one of the key points of contention is whether grandparents count. What the court said was that the ban would not be allowed to go into effect for people with a bona fide relationship with a person or entity in the United States. And so the question is whether grandparents count in that context. The government's initial interpretation of the Supreme Court's order was no, grandparents don't count. And the judge last night in Hawaii said that grandparents do count.
Right. So if I'm somebody from one of these six countries affected by the order, I have a relative of some sort in the United States. It really matters here by the administration's decision what the degree of the relationship is, and this judge just made that a bit wider. Is that right?
Yeah, the judge adopted the position that the state of Hawaii was taking, that it includes relationships like grandparents. You know, when I look at the Supreme Court's decision, the order essentially striking down or continuing the striking down of the ban while this is being resolved in the courts. And I think the Supreme Court uses, as you said, the phrase bona fide relationship. And the Supreme Court gave examples that suggest that the judge last night in Hawaii was correct in defining it to include grandparents.
That's the family side of things. Let's go to the other issue you mentioned for refugees. That relationship, that bona fide relationship, could be not with a family member, but with an organization. And this is a question I think last time we talked to you. Would that mean if I'm a refugee, I've gone through the process for getting refugee status, I have a relationship with a refugee organization in the United States, does that or doesn't it count? So what do we know now?
Well, we know, according to the judge, that in this particular case, that the travel ban cannot be put into effect as to refugees who have the kind of relationship you described, with their being sponsored by an agency that commits to help them get resettled in the United States, and that relationship has been basically information for time. Because we've got to remember that refugees go through quite a bit of vetting in a process that can take years before they come to this country. So it is definitely a bona fide relationship in the sense that it's not in any way short-term or it's really a ongoing relationship. And so now we know that anyone in that category is going to be let in, notwithstanding what the travel ban had to say. I mean, I should say one of the ways to understand this is the Supreme Court gave some specific examples of people that the Supreme Court thought the travel ban should not apply to, and one of them was a student who's admitted to study at a U.S. college or university. Another is someone who's taken a job with a U.S. employer, and so I think the judge in this particular case saying, well, you know, if you've had this relationship through this vetting process with a refugee agency, you know, that clearly was not manufactured for the purpose of getting around the travel ban. And so they're saying, well, this is really like what you have with an employer, what you have with a school. I think the Supreme Court was concerned here with trying to make sure that the status quo, in other words, without the travel ban, was preserved with regard to anyone who might be hurt. And so I think they're saying refugee agencies are hurt if their mission is undercut in this case. And so in a way, it's very similar to what the Supreme Court said with regard to families. And it's so in that sense, what the judge did in this particular case yesterday treats the relationship with refugee agencies in much the same way they treat grandparents and family members.
Hiroshi Monomura is with us from the UCLA School of Law, looking at the latest on the travel ban. So this is in effect instantly? Is this the rule of the country now when it comes to refugees and immigrants from these six countries?
It is in the sense that it applies nationwide. I mean, the theory of that is that the travel ban applies nationwide or applied nationwide, and that this is a judge that is addressing what the Supreme Court, he had to really say, well, this is my best reading of what the Supreme Court said. I would be surprised if it's not, if this ruling isn't appealed further. And so we don't really quite have the last word. And this is essentially a ruling on what's going to be the status quo until this is finally resolved, which may happen in the Supreme Court when the Supreme Court reconvenes in October.
Yeah, Attorney General Sessions said he was planning to, I think, appeal this. But is there a court to appeal it to until this fall? I mean, is this going to stay there until the Supreme Court is back in session now?
Well, I mean, one logical thing to do would be to, this is a district court order that we have right now, so one logical thing to do would be to try to appeal it to the Ninth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals, which has jurisdiction over the western states, including Hawaii. And so that is one option that the federal government could take on this. Another is to try to have an appeal directly to the Supreme Court, which is not actively in session at the moment, but that wouldn't keep it from doing something in this case. I mean, this is really a question of what is going to be the state of things until it comes back to the court later. This is really a question of preliminary injunction.
There have been rumblings about the Trump administration trying to apply maybe not these exact rules, but similar rules to a lot more countries around the world, a more blanket travel restrictions. Is that something you're watching for? What do you expect to see happen?
You know, that's really hard to know. It's really hard to know. You know, a couple of different angles on this. One is to say that much of what the administration is trying to do, it's possible to essentially do what the then candidate Trump talked about is in terms of extreme vetting. And so without a travel ban, we can have much more individualized scrutiny of people. And that may be what a lot of security experts think is really the way to go in terms of a broadening of the ban in terms of more countries. You know, it's really hard to say. I think that I've heard, there have been rumors to that effect, but I think that a lot of them may just be rumors. They may even be ideas that are seriously being floated for reaction. But it's extremely hard to say. As you get to more countries, you run into more issues of diplomatic relations, and so I wouldn't venture a prediction at this point.
Another part of the executive orders has been a reduction in the overall number of refugees, a fairly substantial reduction in the number of refugees who can come into the United States. That there hasn't been any court challenge to that, or is that something that is challengeable, or is that at the discretion of the president?
Well, I mean, we had an overall cap established by then-President Obama that was much higher than the one that the cap's been reduced to. The cap's been reduced to 50,000, according to this executive order. That's less than half of what was originally planned. What you have here, though, is the travel ban, one of the provisions, would reduce it to 50,000. What the court is saying in the court decision we have last night is that the 50,000 cap doesn't apply to anyone who can prove the bona fide relationship with a person or entity in the United States. And so that cap is going to is not going to operate as a cap. It's not going to limit number of admissions if anyone has this prior relationship with a refugee agency.
Hiroshi, thanks for joining us today.
Okay, thank you for having me.
That's Hiroshi Motomura, professor at the UCLA School of Law. He studies immigration and citizenship. He's the author of Immigration Outside the Law. He joined us for a look at a recent ruling from a federal judge that exempts grandparents from President Trump's travel ban on six Muslim-majority countries. That ruling would also allow refugees tied to a resettlement agency enter the United States.
Wisconsin has been struggling with a shortage of teachers for years now. Schools have had trouble finding enough qualified applicants, especially in certain fields.
The DPI eventually adopted emergency rules that would change teacher licensing requirements. The goal was to increase the pool of hireable teachers by making a certification more accessible.
Our next guest says that the emergency effort to address Wisconsin's teacher shortage reflects bigger problems in education that schools will be grappling with this summer. Alan Borsuk joins us now. He's a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School. Alan, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be here.
Well, what are these bigger issues in education that the emergency rules reflect?
Well, the emergency rules reflect a teacher shortage that nobody knows what the numbers are. If you say, how short are they short? Nobody really seems to have figured that out. It's really a hard target to pin down, except if you talk to superintendents or principals, I think pretty much all across the state, in certain subjects, which is to say math, science, a few others, and in certain areas, which is to say the more rural and the more urban, they're scrambling to try to fill jobs, the problem is that these rules are changed now to make it easier to fill the jobs by making it easier to get state licenses. So is that a lowering of standards or is it an easing of excessive bureaucracy? I think you'd find people with both points of view. And my question at the public hearing a few days ago that I was at on this was, I didn't speak at the hearing, I should add, but my question, is this good or is this necessary? And I think the answer was, it's necessary. And if I may say so, the bigger picture is that there is a long-term need to find ways to get more and the most talented people to take a greater interest in teaching. That there's been a big slump in people who are in college programs to become teachers and just an interest in the jobs.
Well, let's step back for a moment. Take us back to when these emergency rules were first put into effect.
Well, they are exactly that, emergency rules. So they're only good for 150 days, and I think the effective date was the middle of June. So they're good till something like the middle of November. The state superintendent, Tony Evers, says that permanent rules will be coming that will look at broader issues of what needs to be done to improve the pipeline for teachers, you know, the process of getting people interested in the job and into the job. And that's a more elaborate process. It could, depending on the specifics, involve legislative action or action by committees of the legislature. But they need to take a bigger look at the whole subject. I think everyone involved agrees on that point.
Are there some sticking points here because these rules would ultimately relax teacher qualifications so that they could make so there more people would be able to be in an applicant pool and that lowering standards?
That's a good question. I don't honestly know. At the hearing, there were people there from a group called the Wisconsin Reading Coalition who are quite assertive about the need for high-quality training of teachers who are going to be teaching kids to read, and especially in some parts of the state, the percentage of kids who are proficient readers is startlingly low. And they argued that this was going to allow more teachers to be exempt from taking the training they need and passing a test that they need to pass to get their licenses. So is that a lowering of standards? If they're right, I would say yes. On the other hand, you could talk to most any teacher in the state and say, what was your experience with the state licensing system? And they'd say, oh, such a bureaucracy. It was so horrible. And even Tony Evers and some of the DPI people agree the system is overly cumbersome. It's slow. It's difficult. There's 95 different licenses, I believe is the correct number. So easing up on the bureaucracy could easily be done without imperiling quality and could be a service to people. So it's a little bit of both.
Well, Tony Evers, as you mentioned, he did say that the system is too complex, needs updating and simplifying. How long would that take to update it?
I'm old. I remember going through this several times before, and each time it's like, hey, we're going to get it right this time, and they haven't so far.
What about a veteran teacher who certified and been in teaching a long time, just wants to do something different in the profession, maybe go into an area where there is a shortage, such as bilingual or math or science, and what would that teacher have to go through who has been in the system many years, perhaps decades, to be able to do something different in their profession?
It will vary from subject to subject, but generally this would ease up on that. And one of the things that people who are involved in the state education systems, who represent school districts and so on, they're saying this is really about internal management of districts, that enrollment might be going down, funding's getting tighter, we need to tighten up some positions, and we don't want to lose our best teachers, who we may have to cut back a little bit of their schedule. So let's give them a subject in a different area, and this is really a positive thing for us. So the rules will make that more possible. But the question is still, is this good or is this a lowering of standards?
We're talking right now with Alan Borsuk. He is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School. We're talking about emergency rules that have been put into place to address a teacher shortage here in Wisconsin. And so, Alan, if you compare Wisconsin with other states, is a teacher shortage universally an issue all across the country? Is Wisconsin unique?
I would say it's pretty much everywhere these days. Maybe there are exceptions, but it's widespread. And the decline in the number of people enrolling in, say, majoring in education in college is quite widespread. Around here, you hear a lot of people say, oh, this is due to Act 10, the whole war against teachers' unions going back 6 years. And I don't minimize the impact of Act 10, but the truth is there are states, even right in this part of the country, where the decline in teacher enrollment is even higher in terms of percentages than in Wisconsin, who didn't have Act 10. So it's a bigger issue. It's a national issue. Teacher quality is a national issue.
We've known a long time that math and education, bilingual education jobs, they're generally hard to fill. Why are they difficult to fill? Shouldn't there be a pipeline by now?
Well, you would hope so. I mean, teaching, in some cases, like math and science, it's sometimes as simple as this. You graduate college with a specialty in math, and a lot of careers beckon, and a lot of them pay a lot better than teaching. So money is one factor. In bilingual, I think there's just a shortage. There's just not enough people getting teaching degrees who are able to work in two languages, not only Spanish, which is the one that comes to mind first and is the most common, but there are kids in Wisconsin schools and sometimes in places you might not think of it who speak just an amazing array of languages. In a place like Milwaukee or some of the other bigger cities, there can be 30 or 40 different languages spoken by students, and there are just not that many people with those skills. And another area is special ed. And I think one of the keys in that is just really hard work. It's very hard for a lot of people to stay in that for too long because it's just difficult. It requires very special people.
So do you think these emergency rules will make a change, will work, will do what is needed to get these teachers into the classroom that are high quality?
My guess is it will help in some cases, in some places. Does it solve the overall problem? Probably not. That said, come September, will there be an adult in every classroom where kids are sitting? Yes. Will they all be qualified as much as you'd like? No. Some of them might be long-term substitutes or kind of patching things together, teachers covering extra duties or who knows what. Are there classrooms that are not going to have a permanent qualified teacher at the head of the room come the first day of school. Probably not a big number, but yes, they will exist, I'm quite sure.
And what happens when the emergency rules expire?
I think the DPI hopes that there'll be more permanent rules ready by then. And to some degree, they'll have a little bit of a break because the main hiring season is now, from late spring to just after the school year starts, let's say. So if they expire in November, they've got a little bit of time to get their act together. Although, I mean, there is teacher hiring throughout the year, but there is a season for it, and it's right now.
We hear so often about top teacher candidates, and you wrote in your piece about the lack of top teacher candidates, but that to me seems like a very subjective turn of phrase. How can we figure out what is a top teacher? Who should we be putting in these classrooms? Is it people who have been there for many years working with students, or people who are just fresh out of school?
It is subjective, in my opinion, and the more efforts they're made to make it objective, to come up with standards, to, you know, the whole movement of several years ago to rate teachers by how their students were doing and how much progress the students were making and such, most of them have not worked out to be successful because it's just so hard. That said, there is certainly such a thing as a teacher who's better than other teachers, and anyone who went to school, which is to say all of us, know it because we had teachers who were more memorable, who drove home their lesson to us more, who got us more into the subjects, who made bigger impacts on us. So you say, how do we have more of those teachers? I wish it were a simple question. I don't know anyone who has an effective answer. Teaching isn't like baseball where everything can be done by statistics, and it's not like business where everything can be done by some kind of objective measures, you know, sales per salesperson or something like that.
Well,
it is subjective.
Alan, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
That was Alan Borsuk, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School, joining us to share his take on the state's effort to address the teacher shortage by setting emergency rules that relax teacher qualifications.
First, it's Food Friday. With summer in full swing, local stores and farmers markets are packed with the fresh fruits and vegetables. So if you want a boost of energy or a quick, nutritious liquid meal, why not throw a bunch of that stuff in a blender and see what happens?
Well, there might be a little more to it than that. Joining us now to offer some guidance on making your own fresh juices and healthy smoothies is Jessica Jean Weston. She's the author of Healing Tonics, Juices, and Smoothies, 100-plus Elixirs to Nurture Body and Soul. Jessica, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, why do you look to smoothies and juices if we're looking to eat healthier? Why go liquid?
Well, I mean, we all tend to drink a lot of liquid beverages that are loaded in sugars that are not good for us. So I love looking at things that I can use in a healthier way. And juices in general always make me feel better, and smoothies you can just throw so much into, so you can get all of your like vitamins and minerals, nutrients in one drink
and take
everything
it to go.
Take it to go. It's quick, easy to whip up before work in the morning, before a workout, after a workout.
I think a lot of people think health food and think healthy but yuck or bland or something like that. And looking at the recipes in your book, it looks like you're really trying to make things that taste good and from the pictures anyway, really look good too.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Well, I also own and operate a restaurant in southern Vermont in Brattleboro called Super Fresh Organic Cafe. And that's my goal, is to serve delicious food that happens to be healthy that for everybody, not just people who eat this way. And we've really seen that over the past 5 years, serving this food in the community, that people are shocked.
So what's some key advice you can give people to get started on this juice and smoothie journey? Where's a good place to start?
Well, the book has loads of information on resources and where to buy these ingredients and just starting simple. You know, you don't have to add all the crazy superfoods that I have in the book. You can start really minimal, you know, start with some milk, whether it's dairy or non-dairy. My book focuses on non-dairy, as I am and the cafe is. But you can use whatever liquid base you want with fresh, or I prefer frozen fruit because it makes it really thick and creamy. And then from there, you really have the world to play with, adding different superfoods or sweeteners.
And what are some fruit marriages that you can't go wrong with? What are some good fruit pairings?
That's a good question. So most of my smoothies, I know that I try to make smoothies once in a while without frozen banana, because most of them have frozen banana in them. But I know some people don't like that. But that being said, frozen bananas are amazing. And so that is a great base to start with. And they're really nice and thick. You can buy them in the frozen aisle, but they're kind of expensive. So I find it better to just get a bunch of bananas, peel them, throw them in a bag in the freezer so they're ready to go.
I want to jump in and step back a bit, and let's talk gear a little. Juicers. Now, I imagine at your restaurant, you've got some pretty fancy high-tech stuff there. But for the home smoothie maker and juicer, what kind of stuff do we need?
We do have fancy stuff at the cafe, and I have to say I didn't have any of that before I owned the cafe. I had never used a Vitamix or a Blendtec before I opened my restaurant. So I had just like a thrift store blender. I have to say that having a high-speed blender allows a lot more, but it is not necessary. So really any blender will work for smoothies. And if you are using nuts or making nut milks, you might just have to soak your nuts or seeds a little longer. For juicers, my favorite recommendation is the Omega 8006 centrifugal. It's kind of like a medium-priced juicer. It's definitely a heftier purchase. It runs around $250. But honestly, I started with a $30 Walmart juicer. So that was my first juice cleanse. So, you know, you just start where you can, and anything's better than nothing.
We're talking with Jessica Jean Weston. She's the author of Healing Tonics, Juices, and Smoothies, 100-plus Elixirs to Nurture Body and Soul. We're discussing smoothies, the health benefits of going liquid. Jessica, many of the recipes in the book feature something called milk, but M-Y-L-K, which is a key ingredient. What is it?
So I don't spell it the traditional way because we are, I'm dairy free and my cafe is also dairy free. So I spell it with a Y to remind people that when I'm making it, or my customers when they come in, that it's not dairy milk. So we make hemp and coconut milk daily, but you can use almost any seed or nut to make milk. And if you do dairy, you can also just use dairy milk for any of these recipes. It's really your choice.
I want to get into one of the recipes, and here's one we've got on our Central Time Facebook page for this week's Food Friday. Walk us through the smoothie you call Bee Love.
Oh, yes. So the Bee Love is really wonderful. That one has a liquid base of pineapple juice, which is so yummy and really great for digestion and gut health. All those enzymes in pineapples are used a lot for digestion health. And then we have a big handful of spinach because I love everything green. And you really don't taste it. People sometimes get scared off by that, but you really don't. We throw in 1.5 frozen bananas, a tablespoon of raw honey that we get locally, and 1 tablespoon of bee pollen, which I say is optional.
And if you would go to find bee pollen, where would you go?
You can find it at most all health food stores, co-ops, Whole Foods. There's also sources online. It's usually in the wellness department in a refrigerator.
And if you don't finish your whole Bee Love in one sitting, can you just throw it into the refrigerator, would you reblend? How would you be able to enjoy it over the course of maybe a day or a couple of different meals?
Well, if you don't, which usually doesn't happen, I probably would recommend throwing it in the freezer. to hold it a little better. It kind of can turn into more of a sorbet at that point, which can also be delicious. You can really make these smoothies into popsicles if you want. And yeah, reblending it is helpful because smoothies definitely lose their form the longer they sit.
And Jessica, you've got a whole chapter on fermentation and some fermented juices. And maybe you don't know this. You're talking to a state that loves its fermentation. There's a whole festival called Fermentation Ooh. Festival here in the state. So can you talk about, there's this drink, kvass, from I think Russia or Eastern Europe. I've never had it before. You've got a couple different recipes, beets, I think, and then fruit kvass. Can you talk about what goes into making our own kvass and what it tastes like?
Yeah, the beet kvass and the fruit kvass are very different. Beet kvass is as simple as just beets washed up and chopped, some salt. I use Himalayan salt, sauerkraut juice or whey, but I'm dairy-free, so again, I'm going to go vegan on this one. And then you just cover that with filtered water, leave that in a jar for a couple days, covered with like a clean rag, just like you would do kombucha or several other ferments have the same type of process. And that one kind of has more of a very salty, earthy, it's not sweet. I really like serving it with some lime juice, maple syrup, and sparkling water, but you can also just drink it straight as a shot, and it has more of a salty, earthy, rooty taste. Whereas the fruit,
If you combined it with sparkling water, you'd get more of a spritzer effect, maybe?
Yeah, it's really good.
And then what's different with the fruit one in making that? Obviously fruit instead of beets, for starters.
Yep, so the fruit one, we're using fruits, raw honey, and water. So the beet kvass doesn't have any sweetener added to it, whereas the fruit kvass is raw honey, fresh fruit, and water. In this recipe in the book, I use ginger root and peppermint with blueberries, but you can make any type of fruit, which I give instructions of how you can alter things to whatever fresh fruit you've got on hand or spices you want to blend. So this one is really a much sweeter beverage, although the fermentation process eats those sugars.
We're talking about making your own healthy juices and smoothies with Jessica Jean Weston. She's the author of Healing Tonics, Juices, and Smoothies, 100-plus Elixirs to Nurture Body and Soul.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you do a lot of juicing at home or make your own smoothies? What are some of your favorites, some of your secret recipes, if you're willing to share? Or do you have questions for our guests on how to make the most of your juicing and smoothing habit? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post and find that recipe on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Jessica Jean Weston. She's the author of the new book, Healing Tonics, Juices, and Smoothies, 100-plus Elixirs to Nurture Body and Soul.
And you can share your smoothie or health food-related questions or comments with us by calling 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page, are you a smoothie lover? Do you have a favorite juice or smoothie you like to make or perhaps order? Join the conversation, 800-642-1234.
And we'll go right to our callers. Susan is with us in Illinois. Susan, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Susan?
Well, I actually have a question. I wanted to get her opinion on adding protein powder to a smoothie.
Okay, and are you a smoothie maker yourself, Susan?
I am.
Okay, daily habit?
A daily habit.
All right. Thanks, Susan. So, adding protein powder of some sort to our smoothies.
Yeah, that's a big question that comes up a lot. So I used to use some plant-based protein powders. I think at the time I was using Garden of Life many years ago. They add lots of great stuff to it. But right now I mostly focus on adding whole foods or superfoods that are high in protein, such as spirulina or hemp seeds, or throwing in a handful of nuts or seeds, chia seeds, all have great protein. And that has a really nice, well-balanced effect. And protein, we often are getting even more than we really need. So that's definitely something to watch out for.
You also use date paste and turmeric paste as bases in your recipes. What do they add?
Well, the date paste is a sweetener choice that you can use. We use mostly either raw honey, maple syrup, or dates. And you can just use soaked dates or date paste. And those are a really nice natural sweetener that are vegan and raw, whereas the other two are either cooked or not vegan. And turmeric paste is extremely medicinal. We make that with turmeric powder, black pepper, and water. And we cook that down into a paste, and we'll use that with hot drinks like our golden milk or in a smoothie that has mangoes in it. We do a golden goddess smoothie that's like a mango lassi meets a golden milk. And that's really anti-inflammatory, going to help release muscle tension and overall body wellness.
And Jessica, I want to talk about the source of some of your recipes. We mentioned kvass from Eastern Europe. You really have looked around the world for inspiration and ingredients, haven't you?
I have. I love it.
Like, what kind of sources have you gone to?
I think it's just been my journey over the years and meeting different people from around the world, or sometimes traveling to different places. I've mostly traveled in Central America. I lived in Belize for a while, spent some time in Mexico. And then just there's so many amazing, inspiring, healing drinks from around the world that I'm obsessed with researching.
Let's go back to the calls now at 800-642-1234. Mark in Milwaukee. Hi, Mark.
Hi, guys. Hey, thanks for taking the call. It's a great topic, by the way. My girlfriend got me into eating really healthy and organically over a year ago now. My question is, though, I have a severe nut and seed allergy, and I'm really interested. We're definitely going to pick up the book. I'm just wondering, what do you suggest to replace those proteins with?
So are you allergic to all nuts and seeds?
Yes. I carry an EpiPen with me.
Wow. I haven't heard the all seeds either. I've heard most the seeds. So does that include coconut?
Actually, no. Coconut is not a nut, and I can't eat coconut.
Okay. Coconut's great. And does that like include chia seeds too?
It does. Sunflower, even poppy seeds. I can't.
Okay.
My body just rejects
wow.
them.
Well, so your question's in terms of protein?
Yes.
There's so
like,
much plant based.
So replacing like nuts and mainly I guess nuts would be the big one.
Yeah. Well, protein is spirulina has such an amazing bioavailable source of protein, and you use just such a tiny amount. So that's really great to add to juices or smoothies or other drinks. And let's see, kale has more protein per serving per ounce than steak. So that's often, you know, all these big leafy greens are really great additions. And I have loads of other recommendations in the book. There's a whole ingredient glossary that details all the health benefits of all the different superfoods I'm using. And a lot of them are very highly concentrated in protein and not nut or seed based.
Mark, hope that helps and good luck. We're talking to Jessica Jean West, and her new book is Healing Tonics, Juices, and Smoothies, 100 Plus Elixirs to Nurture Body and Soul. One tip I like, Jessica, I should say I make a smoothie pretty much every day, and I usually use water to fill out the liquid part of it, which is quick and easy and kind of boring.
Yeah.
You talk about, hey, experiment with the liquids. You talked about, you know, dairy milk or those nut milks or making your own nut milk, but you also talk about herbal teas as a replacement for the water. What kind of things do you throw in?
Oh, well, I get a little crazy and make my milks with herbal tea as the water. But that's a little further down the line. I love chaga and different medicinal mushroom teas like reishi. Astragalus is really nice. And And a lot of these, when you're adding other all the fresh fruits or different superfoods, cacao, all those yummy add-ons, you don't really taste that much of, unless you're going for a tea that has, say, rose or something in it. But that can be a really wonderful flavor in itself.
Let's go to another call now. Catherine in Wausau. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Okay, I make smoothies all the time. And until I realized what my base was going to be, I was never so satisfied as I am now. I use the coconut oil, and I think it has like, not oil, the coconut water, and I use, it's all natural, it's by Zycol. And with that, you can add fruits, vegetables, nuts, whatever you want. And I also use the doTERRA brand Slim and Sassy protein powder and their greens from the doTERRA brand. And I get so much energy from that. And it fills my need for wanting anything to eat. So there, that's it in a nutshell.
A coconut shell. Catherine, thanks for the call. Do you use coconut water, Jessica?
I do. One of my smoothies in the book uses it, and I use it pretty frequently. It's a really great light base that's filled with, you know, going to fill you with energy, all those electrolytes. A much healthier choice than sports drinks that are out there to refuel your body. And I use a lot of doTERRA products as well. I haven't used those two specific ones, but I like adding food grade essential oils sometimes, which is not listed much in my book, but another yummy added trick.
Well, smoothies really speak to us in these warm summer days, hot summer days, cooling off with a refreshing smoothie. Are there variations for the winter months?
For smoothies, you know, you can go more warming routes, but I tend not to drink as many smoothies in the winter months. That's when I look more towards my hot elixirs that you'll find in the book. And I add superfoods and seeds, powders to those drinks as well. So it's kind of a different vehicle.
And Jessica, what you're a bit of a mad scientist, clearly, when it comes to juices and smoothies. What's your latest experiment? What are you excited about?
Oh, goodness. Actually, one that, let's see. So this is, no, that's not a smoothie.
Okay. Anything in the genre is fine.
Well, so this has juice in it, but it's a hot chocolate drink. So we've been making this red velvet hot chocolate at
we'll
the cafe.
Allow that.
So we start by juicing a beet. And then we add almond butter, cashews, raw cacao powder, vanilla, a pinch of salt, milk, and hot water. And it makes this really creamy, luscious, pink, chocolatey drink. So I've been really having fun adding juices to other drinks that you wouldn't necessarily think of adding juices to.
Sounds fantastic. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
That's Jessica Jean Weston, author of Healing Tonics, Juices, and Smoothies, 100-plus elixirs to nurture body and soul. We've been talking about juicing and smoothies and red velvet hot chocolate, for that matter. You can find her smoothie recipe for Bee Love on the Central Time Facebook page or by checking out today's Food Friday page on WPR.org. Are you a big smoothie maker, Kate?
I do like smoothies. I go in phases, and it's whatever is in the freezer.
I am a person of habit. And my habit since I got a smoothie maker is every single morning I'm making a smoothie. And my smoothie maker's still working even after I dumped some smoothie, I was half awake, into the base of the smoothie maker. It cleaned up just fine.
All right.
Check out the Central Time Facebook page for that recipe. It's a big weekend for TV shows, especially in the science fiction and fantasy genre. The new season of Game of Thrones starts on Sunday, for one thing.
And there's big news on the way for fans of the long-running British science fiction show Doctor Who, a popular show with a long connection to public broadcasting.
The news will find out who's going to play the newest incarnation of the Doctor, the 13th in a long-running line.
The character of the Doctor goes way back to 1963, and while the character is sort of the same, the actors have changed. Why science? The Doctor is a member of a species that takes on new forms and personalities over the course of a lifespan.
And that's very convenient from a producer's point of view. When one actor's contract is up, you can just bring in another and write the change into the script. So it's like if, you know, Sean Connery on camera in 007 movies morphed into Roger Moore, or for a later generation, Pierce Brosnan into Daniel Craig.
Yeah, we get the picture. There have been lots of rumors, including the idea that the first woman to play the Doctor could come. The announcement comes this Sunday after the Wimbledon men's final.
I was a Doctor Who fan back in the 80s, the Tom Baker era. Have you checked out the show?
Not recently, no, but I do remember it growing up.
Well, here's I think a more recent version of the theme song than when I watched it. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.